From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, what can an IQ test really tell you about anyone's potential? The filmmaker Dan Habib raises this question in his work. He has a son with intellectual disabilities who was labeled by an IQ test. Habib makes documentaries that make the case for including the disabled in mainstream life, but also for challenging our perceptions about intelligence. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nicole Nixon, a reporter here at KUER. I cover state politics and government, which means it's my job to interview lawmakers, go to committee meetings, and track hundreds of bills. During the recent legislative session, I was on Capitol Hill every day to report on Medicaid expansion, gun laws, and the state budget, issues that affect you. KUER is committed to high-quality, deep-dive political coverage here in Utah. If that's something that you value, support our newsroom with a contribution. Just go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Tonight in Salt Lake City, the filmmaker Dan Habib is receiving an award from the Utah Film Center. They're partners in our documentary series, and every year the Film Center pays tribute to a filmmaker or a subject who challenges the perception of people with disabilities. Habib has a son with cerebral palsy, and he makes documentaries about his challenge and the challenge of others to integrate young people with disabilities into the regular education system or the workforce. And Habib wants people to have a more expansive view of the nature of intelligence. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his work and his latest film. It's called Intelligent Lives. So you begin the film with the story of Chris Cooper, the actor whose son Jesse, as you point out, is cerebral palsy. And he tells the story of this struggle that he has, he and his wife, with the medical and the educational community to have their son included, you know, in general education. And I wanted to begin there because it reveals, it seems like, the central issue in the film. Tell a little bit about this story. I mean, the first thing that Cooper mentions is how a neurologist told him and his wife that their son would never be intellectually normal, and they tell them this right in front of him. He's only 4 years old, but let's start with that story, if we could.
Sure. So first of all, Chris Cooper, many of your listeners may know, is an Academy Award-winning actor. He was in Adaptation, the movie. He's been in the Bourne conspiracy movies, the Muppets movie, some of you may know. So, but he had never told his own story in this way. And I'm fortunate my wife and I have been friends with Chris and his wife, Marianne Leon Cooper, about 10 years. So they have a son, Jesse, and Jesse had cerebral palsy and could not communicate in a typical way. But at the time, in the school district they were in, the school district said, well, we need Jesse to take an IQ test in order to assess his intellect and his ability to be included in regular school. So they were just in disbelief at Jesse, who had very large issues with mobility, with communication, was asked to answer these questions like, Jesse, do you dust a dresser? And in the film, Chris says, we don't dust in our household. We call dressers bureaus, and I've never thought of asking my son, who has quadriplegia, to dust a dresser. It would be one thing if you could just kind of write off the IQ test and say, well, isn't that ridiculous? That doesn't represent my child's intelligence or my intelligence. But the issue, the real issue, is that the way a person scores on an IQ test, both in childhood and adulthood, has a direct impact on their trajectory as an adult and throughout their whole educational and professional experience. And an example of that is I have an extended family member who's a teacher, and she recently started coaching in a district here in the United States. And she was going from one building to another, and in one building, all the kids with disabilities were completely included with their peers. The next building, same age range, and all the kids were completely segregated from their peers. And she asked the principal, why is this? Why do we have such different scenarios in each school, in each building? And the principal said, oh, well, the kids who were included had a 56 or above IQ. The kids that were segregated had a 55 or below. That's just one example of many I could give you about the way IQ testing still plays a very prominent role in the segregation of people with disabilities in our society.
We should mention your own personal connection to this story.
Right.
You've already made a documentary about your son Samuel and your own struggle.
Yes.
to include him in general education. What's the other thing you wanted to say? What else did you want to say? Not that you'd completely said everything with that previous film, but what's the other part of this that you're saying with this film?
Right. Well, this is my third feature-length film, and including Samuel, who's, as you said, focused on my son. So my son Samuel, first of all, is now 19, even though he was about 4, 5, 6 years old in that film. He's in college. He's taking community college classes. He's doing well. He's doing a year-long leadership program with the University of New Hampshire. He had his first paid job last summer. He's got a great circle of friends. Samuel also has cerebral palsy, like Jesse. He has a seizure disorder. He doesn't speak very easily, so he uses a communication device, a computer that's mounted to his wheelchair. He's got a feeding tube. He's got an underlying genetic disorder. You know, I tell you this because that's the whole picture for Samuel. And Samuel is doing so many amazing things, and he's been at grade level his entire life in school and included in regular school. But still, when we are out and about in community, people often talk to him like he's a five-year-old because he uses a wheelchair. Because he has a physical disability. And when I speak to audiences, and especially people who use wheelchairs, I get a lot of nods and knowing looks when I say that, because it really illustrates our very narrow perceptions of intelligence. And that was why I started this film, was to really look at how does our society look at intelligence? Is that definition too narrow? And is it heavily based on the IQ test? And if I were to be down in Salt Lake City tomorrow or next week when I'm there and said, you know, hey, how do you measure intelligence? I bet 9 out of 10 people would say the IQ test. So the starting point for this film was to challenge people to look at intelligence differently and broaden their perception of what it means to be intelligent.
You mentioned how it wasn't long ago when parents of intellectually disabled children were encouraged to send their children to institutions. It's another one of the things you explore. And then as you put it in the film, a child's low IQ was their one-way admission ticket to these institutions. So they were institutionalized in times past, but also, as you say, labeled. And really, a label that seems to mark them or has marked them for a good part of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing out a thread that we have in the film around the history around some of this. And we do have some very powerful scenes narrated by Chris Cooper that looks back at how IQ testing was used to actually do things like limit immigration. In fact, the psychologist Goddard, who was famous for kind of misusing the IQ test in the United States, was using IQ testing at Ellis Island to determine who could come in and who couldn't. And he was determining that 80% or higher of Jews, Italians, and Russians were feeble-minded because they were scoring low on IQ tests and shouldn't be allowed in. And then he and others continued to form something called the eugenics movement, mm-hmm. which some people may be familiar with, which led to this hundreds of thousands of people being institutionalized because they were seen as being, quote unquote, morons, idiots. Those were actually clinical terms that they were using, feeble-minded, to say we need to get these people away from society and put them in these awful institutions. And then they decided, you know what, we need to take it a step further. We need to sterilize people so that they can't procreate. And 60,000 people in this country were forcibly sterilized because of things like the way they scored on an IQ test. And I tell this history in the film not to make people upset per se, but to help people understand our history as a country. And it's a pretty sordid history, because if you don't understand the history like that, just as if you don't understand that we are a country that has a history of slavery and racism, you don't understand the Black Lives Matter movement. If you don't understand that we're a country with a history of, you know, oppression and harassment of women, you don't understand Me Too and on. You don't understand the modern day disability rights movement and the inclusive education movement unless you understand this history.
Let's back up a little bit more even, because you tell the story of the first IQ test published in 1905. Tell us a little bit about Alfred Binet, because he had a particular idea in mind. He had a sense of the nature of intelligence. I mean, it was distorted by people like Goddard, as you said. But what was his intent? What was the idea at first?
Yeah, I did a lot of research for this film, obviously, and one of my expert advisors was Dr. Michael Waymeyer, who's out of Kansas, and he is an international expert around the history of intellectual disability, and he really helped me understand that Alfred Binet, the French psychologist, designed this test. He didn't call it the IQ test at the time. You know, it was had different names, the Binet test, and it became the Stanford Binet test eventually. He designed it to identify children that needed additional assistance. That was the idea. We want to see if there are certain kids that might need extra help in school, and we're going to give them that assistance based on this assessment. Well, that test became distorted when it came to the United States, and Goddard and others started using it as a way to kind of weed out certain types of people in our society.
How did Binet see intelligence? It's one of the things that you mention in the film. He had this sense of it as having this fluid quality, and it was shaped, as you say in the film, by a person's environment and culture. Is that the right way to think about the nature of intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Binet was probably ahead of his time in that respect, and that, as you said, he saw intelligence as something that evolved over time. It was affected by culture, and that was a widely accepted view at that time. You know, like in many things in our history, there's ebbs and flows in our perceptions of things. But if you look, even jumping ahead to the modern day, you know, we're obviously still using the intelligence test broadly in this country, but there has been some pushback and some understanding about those cultural influences. For example, in California, there was some realization years ago that there was a tremendous disparity between the scores that African Americans were getting on IQ tests versus whites. And they said, you know what? We are seeing such cultural bias here. We're actually going to outlaw the use of IQ tests on African Americans. And that still is in existence. So you see these pockets of awareness that IQ testing, just like Binet saw it, does not really represent a person's ability to contribute meaningfully, you know, in education and employment and relationships. But it is still in place, as we say in the film, in 49 out of 50 states are still using IQ tests to determine if someone has an intellectual disability. Once they have that label, they're much more likely to be segregated in school. Only 17% of students with intellectual disability are included. Right. Only 40% of those students will graduate from high school by the age of 21. And as adults, only 15% will be employed. So, you know, I'm not saying the IQ test is the only variable here or the only factor. There's lots of factors, but it is still a significant obstacle and a significant stigma that's affecting the 6.5 million Americans that have this label of intellectual disability.
One of the stories you tell in the film is of Micah Fialka Feldman. And Micah's story is interesting. He is getting as we meet him in the film, he's getting a certificate in disability studies at Syracuse. I mean, he's moved from Michigan. He's become quite independent, away from his mother and father and sister. And there's this professor at Syracuse who you interview, James Byrne, who talks about what a test can't get at, the gifts, the talents that Micah has. And I wanted to play this and talk a little bit about it. Here's another moment from the film. This is James Byrne.
The IQ test measures a very limited potential of our brain to learn and misses all the other stuff.
Now release that.
Person's ability to take context, clues from their environment, from other people. A person's desire to engage with other people and their openness to relationships. Micah's got a ton of that.
Say a little bit more about that, what he's getting at there, because it seems like the thing that an IQ test can't properly get at is like the social potential, the one-on-one. Say a little bit more about that, if you would.
Right. Sure. It helps to give you a little bit more insight about Micah and his story. So just briefly, Micah was the first person I chose for this film. When you're doing documentary work, the most important thing is finding the right people to film and to document. And Micah's a paradigm shifter, just like the other people in the film. Micah is, as you said, going to Syracuse. He's not only taking classes there, he's co-teaching classes. He's got a vibrant circle of friends. He's got a girlfriend. He's living in his own apartment with a roommate. And he was given an IQ of 40 when he was a kid, which would be considered profoundly intellectually disabled by, you know, terminology. So what I think Professor Byrne is getting at is Micah has such an impact on so many people through his social and emotional skills. He's constantly on social media. He's constantly, you know, making plans with people. He's constantly giving people positive feedback, positive energy into their lives. I did an event recently where a relative of Micah said, you know, I had a serious illness, and Micah was the first person to call me and to say, can I come visit you? How can I support you? How can that be measured? How can that be measured in any tangible way, the impact that someone like Micah has on a person like that's lives? So, you know, and it's interesting. I ask a lot of audiences this question when I speak to them. I say, when you think of, you know, school, when you think of K through 12 school, what had a bigger impact on you? Was it the academic experience that maybe would help you score better on an SAT or an IQ test? Or was it the social and emotional experience of school that made you who you are today? 95% of people say it's the social and emotional. So I think if we really think of our own identities, that social and emotional piece is the primary piece of who we are. But it's not the kind of thing that gets measured to tell you what parts of society you're going to have access to.
You also refer in the film to the developmental psychologist Howard Gardner, who talks about the idea that we all have these multiple intelligences, that we think spatially. We think, some think in language, some think in logic. Say a little bit more about that, because it gave me a sense of the sort of broader scope of what we mean when we say intelligence.
Yeah, Gardner's theories have been out there for decades now, and they really were groundbreaking at the time, because to really understand that people can express their intelligence through all different ways, through art, through music, through, you know, kinesthetics. You know, my older son is a rock climber, and he calls rock climbing the Rubik's Cube for the body, you know, trying to figure out each move, and that takes a certain kind of intelligence. And so I think that what the way that Gardner's theories are really applied to the modern world in very effective ways are classrooms that are universally designed for all kinds of learners, for kids who might learn auditorially or experientially or through text or through interactions. Those are the classrooms that are the most inclusive to all kinds of learners, and then also letting those learners express themselves in different ways. So the educators and the employers and people who have taken Gardner's work seriously, they understand that learning is not a one-size-fits-all. But unfortunately, still a lot of the way we are teaching kids, a lot of the way we are designing workplaces is in this very traditional way of just learning through text or learning through certain areas. And I'm seeing that change, but I'm impatient to see it change more quickly because not having these classrooms universally designed limits a lot of the access to kids like Micah.
You mentioned Chris Cooper saying the IQ test basically told him nothing about his son's potential. It had no way of predicting a person's value or ability to contribute to the world. So why is it still used in 49 of 50 states? What is the argument for it now, as you can tell?
Well, I don't think a lot of people are arguing against it, for one thing. I think that when you have certain structures that just exist in society, it's hard to break them down, you know, and that's and you could look at a lot of different things. Even within special education and regular education, we have these silos, you know, that have been established over decades. And the IQ test is a pretty efficient sorting mechanism. Is it what's best for kids? I would argue no, it's not. It also ends up sorting adults as to whether they're going to have access to services for services of support as adults with disabilities. So, you know, I've had some, you know, mostly the film has been extremely well received all over the country, but I'll say that I've had some pushback from some psychologists, especially school psychologists, who say, why aren't you talking about the positive things in the IQ test? And I say, you know, when something is the norm, and we need to take a close look at the norm to see if it's really problematic or really needs to change. My job as a documentary filmmaker is not to prop up the norm. It's to shine a light on something that needs to have very close scrutiny and say, even if it's hard to do, is there a better way? Is there a different way that we could be assessing kids and determining, you know, where they're going to go to school or where they're going to get jobs?
But what is that argument that they're making? What are the positive things about the IQ test? What are they saying that are good?
IQ, the intelligence test, whatever you call them, IQ test, they can tell you about a person's learning style. They can help you understand if that person has certain disabilities in math or reading or spatial relations. And so it can definitely get some important information. The problem comes often when that information is communicated to families, to the students or adults, to teachers. And I've talked to people who are very experienced in the field of psychology who say, you know, the reports that are being written are not being written to be understood by families or educators. And so they don't really help. And the number that comes out of it has become a very large stigma in our society. And there's some common knowledge about certain numeric values to your IQ and what that means about you as a person and what your expectations of that person are going to be. So when you hear of someone like Micah that has a 40 IQ, you're not going to picture somebody necessarily that's in college, that has a girlfriend, that's living on their own. I will say that the National Association of School Psychologists actually put financial support behind this film because they really want to have this conversation on a national level. They think it's important.
It seems like it's what Binet was going. Binet was saying, let's develop this test to figure out how we can help people who might be disabled. So he has this good intention, but then it gets distorted. So you have a test that might have good intentions, but it's not being applied properly, it sounds like.
Right. And there are exceptions. I mean, we say 49 out of 50 states. So the one state that's not using it in this way is Iowa.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is Iowa has something called non-categorical service delivery, which is a mouthful. But what it basically means is we're going to get services to the kids that need them, regardless of whether they're given a disability category like intellectually disabled or physically disabled. We're just going to have a system in place that's very well thought out that delivers services to people. So that's why Iowa doesn't rely on the IQ tests. And they have very high rates of educational outcomes and inclusion. There is also an alternative called the support intensity scale, which I went through with my son Samuel. And the idea is they look at your support needs and they do this long assessment and figure out where do you need support in order to fully participate in school, in community, in adult life.
Yeah.
And the number that comes out of that has nothing to do with intelligence. It's just what is the intensity of your support needs. So there are alternatives to the IQ test that exists right now that could be used to take away that stigma.
There's another aspect of this that you explore in the film, and it sort of gets at this issue of looking at behavior as communication. Let's talk about Nair. Tell us about Nair first.
Well, Nair was the second person I started filming, and I from the beginning, I knew I wanted to film in a college, mm-hmm. in a high school, and in employment. Yeah. So Micah was my college story. Nair became my high school story because I knew about this wonderful public high school in Boston called the Henderson School. It's just a public school in Dorchester, Massachusetts. It's a quite low-income neighborhood. It's predominantly non-white. And they include all kids with disabilities in regular classes. It's just a completely inclusive school. So I went to the principal, Patricia Lampron, who plays an important role in the film as well, and said, can you introduce me to some of students here that I might want to film? I met Nair, and I said, don't introduce me to anybody else. I was just completely captivated by him. He's a very handsome man. He's about 6'1". He's African-American, and he's a very talented artist. He also has autism. He has trouble communicating verbally. And so when I started filming Nair, I just found that he was expressing his incredible intelligence, if you want to call it that, and his capabilities in many ways, but particularly through his art. And we end up showcasing the art quite a bit in the film.
What's interesting about this story, too, is that at times he expresses Nair frustration and its behavior that could be perceived as kind of confusing. Here he is, a tall, young black man. And if he's on the street or in some other public setting where people don't understand his situation, it could be problematic. And it's something that is addressed in the film by a teacher at Henderson, Samuel Teixeira, and his father, Jamal Shaheed. Here's another moment from the documentary.
I think he's acting a lot more erratic this year. So if he's not given the benefit of the doubt, whether it's a police officer or just a sort of civilian in society, you do have to wonder what's going to happen.
I want him to go into a world where he's looked at as a fellow citizen of this world. Not someone, oh, there's a tall black guy who's acting weird. Let me call back up.
How is this idea of perception, of looking at behavior and making a judgment, how does that play into this story?
So when I was interviewing Jamal, his father, and Donna, his mom, and then Samuel Teixeira, the history teacher, and this theme kept coming up of, okay, we're in this bubble at Henderson School where everyone appreciates each other and accepts each other, and we really understand that behavior is a form of communication. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in the film that you may recall where Nair, his elbow just suddenly kind of jerks up and he hits his art teacher, his beloved art teacher, Joseph Zaremba, in the face accidentally.
Yeah.
Now, what would happen if that was a police officer?
Right.
What would happen if he had just been pulled over or someone was talking on the street and Nair got nervous and accidentally hit the police officer? What could happen? I mean, I hate to even think about it. But that's why that theme was important to really play out in the film and develop once it came up. And, you start filming someone like Nair and what you don't realize is like how incredible his teachers are going to be or how incredible his parents are going to be. But there's this idea of intersectionality, that you can't look at something like disability or inclusion in a vacuum. Gender matters, race mm-hmm. matters, ethnicity matters, your ability to speak English matters, your ability to navigate the culture and self-advocate matters, and all those themes play out throughout the film.
That's Dan Habib. His film is Intelligent Lives. The Utah Film Center is screening it tonight at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. He'll be there for a Q&A after the film. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, We're talking about this question. What can an IQ test really tell you about anyone's potential or their ability to contribute to the world? We have with us the filmmaker Dan Habib, who raises this question in his work. He has a documentary called Intelligent Lives. I want to talk about Naomi, because this is the third pillar to the story. And this sort of gets us at, the value of work, the idea of inclusion in terms of the workforce with people who have intellectual disabilities. Tell us about Naomi. This story plays out in Rhode Island.
It does, yeah. Naomi was the hardest person to find, actually, for the film, because I had already started filming Nair and Micah. I filmed Nair from his freshman year to his senior year of high school. I filmed Micah for about the same amount of time. And I knew I wanted to tell an employment story. And I wanted to find someone in New England, near where I live in New Hampshire, a woman, because I already had two guys on board. I wanted to find someone with Down syndrome, because that's a really important part of the intellectual disability community. I like my films to be diverse, so I was hoping they'd be non-white. And finally, they needed to be transitioning from what is called a sheltered workshop into competitive, paid, integrated employment. And a sheltered workshop is a place that still exists in many parts of the country where people with disabilities work in a segregated setting, often for subminimum low wages. So to find that in all one person was not easy. I had to do a lot of research, a lot of networking. It took me about 6 months until I found Naomi. So Naomi is in Rhode Island. She had been in a high school called the Birch School that, believe it or not, had one of these sheltered workshops in the high school. So she, instead of doing science and math and English throughout her day, she was being asked and told to assemble jewelry, which was then going to be sold and shipped off, and she saw no money from it. It was such an awful situation that it became the centerpiece of a U.S. Department of Justice lawsuit in 2014 against Rhode Island, and they ended up winning and settling, and now Rhode Island is shutting down all the sheltered workshops and transitioning everyone, including Naomi, into real paid jobs.
How did they justify that at the Birch School, if they did? Because that does come up, the question of what they determined was quote-unquote education was this, as you said, assembling crappy stuff to sell. I mean, how did they say that that was education? I mean, no math, no reading, no science. Is it that just that they figured these people with intellectual disabilities couldn't do that? I mean, what was the justification for that? I couldn't figure that out.
You've basically alluded to it, and I could sum it up in two words: low expectations.
Yeah.
Low expectations. And that is, you know, if you talk to any parent of a child with a disability, myself and many people I know, obviously for my son who has some underlying health issues, my biggest concern is that he stay healthy, you know, and that we protect his health. Our second biggest worry, my wife and I, is low expectations, that people have low expectations for him. Thankfully, we've been surrounded by mostly high expectations here in New Hampshire where we live. But in Naomi's case, you know, a lot of people just didn't think they were capable of more. And it wasn't until she received some very effective and progressive job supports through this place called the Fogarty Center that they showed Naomi's capable of so much more. They started doing job rotations for her. And this was when she's well out of school. She was in her mid-20s at this point, yeah, after the lawsuit. And as you see in the film, you know, they tried some things that didn't work as well, like making change and when her math skills weren't that good and trying to do some commerce. But once they found a really incredibly welcoming and interactive and social environment, this Empire Beauty School, Naomi thrived and ended up, as people see in the film, getting a job there.
Only 15% of the 6.5 million Americans who are intellectually disabled are employed.
Mm-hmm.
Put that number in perspective for us, if you would.
It's awful.
It's awful.
Yeah, I would venture to say there's not another group of Americans that has a lower employment rate as a group. You know, it's really awful. I mean, as most of us know, the unemployment rate is quite low right now in this country. And so I really see people with disabilities as this incredible, untapped labor market, you know, and increasingly some of the more progressive businesses, including some in Silicon Valley, are understanding that people with disabilities can be employed. I as part of this overall project, I actually did some short films on really good practices in helping young adults with disabilities transition into adulthood, into college and career. But one of those tells the story of a corporation called Medtronic, which is a huge $60 billion medical manufacturing company. And they have found through the interviews I did with them that hiring more people with disabilities actually helps their business, largely because as a whole, through statistics that we're seeing, people with disabilities tend to be among the most reliable employees. Mm-hmm. They tend to have some of the highest job satisfaction. They bring a lot of positive energy into the workplace. They have a lot of retention. They keep their jobs longer. You know, I hate to generalize about any community, but I'm just citing research that shows that people with disabilities become some of the very best employees. And also, there's this kind of fear that is not rational, that you're going to have to spend lots of money on accommodations to have someone with a disability in the workplace. The average cost to accommodate someone with a disability is $500 a year. And I will tell you that almost every business you talk to would gladly pay $500 in a year to have a really great employee.
I want to come back to Micah's story for a moment because it talks about, it really conveys another important issue you get at. And that is this question of how much independence we, you know, allow people with intellectual disabilities. And Micah's story is interesting because he's at the particular moment that you're filming him, he's got a girlfriend, he's dating this girl, and mm-hmm. his family, they sound super progressive. They're giving him this independence to leave and live on his own. He's part of this so-called self-direction program at school. And then he's dating this girl whose family's they're a little bit more guarded with this girl. And I think it's an interesting contrast. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. So Micah, you know, a little bit of the backstory also on Micah is that his family is also nationally known in terms of their advocacy for 30 years since Micah's been on this earth. You know, they've been incredibly progressive and really on the cutting edge. And that's not something we play out a lot in the film, but they're an amazing family. And from the very beginning, at a time when a lot of students like Micah were not being included in regular education, they were pushing for inclusion. You know, when he was ready to make the move from Michigan to Syracuse, they supported that, mm-hmm. even though a lot of parents would be very nervous. And then he started dating Megan. And that was, you know, fortuitous thing for the film because it added a nice level of another topic around relationships. And Megan is a very independent young woman in her own right. She's also going to college. She does live at home with her family. Actually, I'm sorry. She moved out recently and she has her own apartment. She has a job. But Megan and Micah, their families do have a little bit different levels of autonomy that they're willing to give to their kids. And in Megan's case, her parents weren't really that keen on she and Micah having a lot of unsupervised time together, and Micah very much wanted to have unsupervised time together yeah. with Megan, you know, yeah. as just a 30-year-old man wants sure. to be with his girlfriend. And so it created some tension, and they ended up breaking up. They're still on good terms, but Micah has, you know, talked about that publicly, so I can share that. And so that's something that I think was important to show in the film as well, that, you know, relationships are hard, no matter what your ability or disability. Mm-hmm. And there's one of my favorite scenes in the film. They're at a party together. It's actually Micah's birthday party, and Megan's hanging around. Her mom's going to pick her up at 10, and Micah's getting a little bit uneasy. Like, he doesn't know what to talk about it anymore. He doesn't know what right. they should do. Yeah. So he kind of starts checking his watch, and he says, "Do you think your mom could pick you up a little early?" Yeah. And the audiences really tend to laugh with that. And I say afterwards, "Listen, who hasn't had an awkward date? You know, I certainly have, and that's real life. And there's a lot of humor in the film, and I want people to know that too. There's a lot of humor in the film, and I feel like that's an important entry point for people to be able to laugh while they're watching a film that also has some difficult material.
Say a little bit more about the self-direction program, and I'm wondering if there are a lot of programs like this.
Yeah, there's actually two kind of really cool things happening in Micah's life in the film. One is that something he's been doing since he was a kid is called the Circle of Support. And that's where he brings together friends. And he's been doing this from elementary school and now does it at Syracuse, who he just calls upon to kind of give him advice, you know, and to help him think about how to navigate school or what kind of jobs, what he might put on his resume, what he might ask Megan's parents about. And they give him the advice, don't talk about politics and religion.
Right.
And then, of course, I was filming right before the 2016 presidential election, the scene, and his dad says, his military dad, Megan's father, says, "So, Micah, who are you voting for in the presidential right. election?" And Micah was a big Bernie supporter, but he kind of hemmed and hawed and said, "Yeah, I'm not sure yet." And he handled it very well. So anyway, the Circle of Support is a very progressive model. And then there's the self-direction, which is more of a model through Medicaid funding. It's more of something that New York is doing to, rather than having the funding go to an agency that then determines who's going to be there to support Micah, you know, what staff might be hired mm-hmm. to help him go shopping or cook or things that he does need some support on, he's in charge. He's actually directing the budget. He's making the hires. He's signing the paychecks. And that has a huge impact on the relationship between Micah and his support staff. And it gives him a sense of control over his life. So those are both two very progressive models that I'm seeing more and more around the country.
The film also tells the story about the history of the sort of civil rights component to this, all of this story, the movement that begins, I guess it's in the 80s with how people with intellectual disabilities, as you put it in the film, start to become their own advocates. Talk a little bit about this era and how it shapes the story.
Yeah, I thought it was important to have this through line through the film and kind of connect the dots between how did we get from institutionalization to Micah being in college and Naomi in the workforce and Nair included in a high school. And the way that happened was, you know, like a lot of social change through multiple channels. One was this idea of parent advocacy and families. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, actually, a lot of this started rolling with John F. Kennedy. And he had a sister, Rosemary, who was intellectually disabled. And unfortunately, their father, well, I think, unfortunately, made the decision to try to have a lobotomy, and also, and then she ended up being institutionalized. It's a well-known story for a lot of people. So we talk about that in the film, that in the 60s, through some political changes, through the president's sister, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, starting the Special Olympics, things started changing. The perception of people with disabilities started changing, but it didn't just happen arbitrarily. You know, people were really pushing the needle. Then in the 70s, in the late 60s, early 70s, the parent advocacy movement became very, very strong, with parents rising up and saying, we want our kids to be seen as fully contributing members of society in school and employment in every aspect. And then, you know, in a natural course, the people started, you know, standing up for themselves and started rallying and protesting and climbing up the steps of the Supreme Court and making lots of noise. And there were certain champions in the U.S. government like Senator Edward Kennedy and Bob Dole and others who ended up helping the Americans with Disabilities Act pass by the first President Bush, who signed it. And so, you know, you see laws, you see cultural shifts, you see advocacy. And then, of course, you see even in popular culture, different portrayals of people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. All these things contribute to the change. I capture some of that in the film. I can't capture all of it. But I don't think social change happens for any one reason. It happens from multiple things in society happening at the same time. And sometimes we have regression. We don't always move forward, which is why I feel so strongly about continuing to make films like this and keep it in the public eye.
Yeah. The film, of course, gets at what effect inclusion has on people with intellectual disabilities. But let's talk about what the impact is with, for example, kids in schools to have other kids with significant disabilities in their classrooms. Chris Cooper talks about this for his own son, Jesse, in the film. Here's another moment.
Could any intelligence tests have predicted the impact our son's life had on the children who went to school with him? On his best friend, Kyle, now a teacher of English language learners, who says Jesse taught him how to draw out a world of ideas from each of his students. Or on Jamie, his middle school girlfriend, who said Jesse motivated her to teach music, helping children to raise their voices in song. On the parents and teachers who hear his story and read his poetry, and then determined to fight harder for inclusion.
Can we measure the impact? What can you say about what we know? What effect does this have on the other kids in class?
Right. I mean, the themes that Chris brought out in that clip and your question brings out is really the heart of my whole career as a filmmaker. And it's really why I'm so honored to get this Peak Award on Monday night, the first, because it's about my body of work that I've been trying to do for the last dozen years, which is all about that. It's about saying that in the inclusion of people with disabilities, there's 30 years of research that shows in education, there's no doubt that people with disabilities, students with disabilities who are included, have better outcomes when they're included in regular classes in every way, in communication and post-secondary education, employment, behavior, everything. But they're also finding more and more that students without disabilities benefit in both very tangible ways and less tangible ways. Mm-hmm. There was a study that came out by a great researcher at Vanderbilt University, Eric Carter, that actually showed that students without disabilities who were learning in inclusive classrooms, you know, diverse classrooms with kids with and without disabilities, were actually having higher rates of achievement on their tests. And he's found because they were having more interesting conversations. They were talking to each other about the material in lots of different ways. They were reteaching the material. They were, you know, looking at it from different points of view, from different learning styles. So they were learning the material more effectively. And every story that I've seen, every research piece that I've seen, shows nothing but positive academic outcomes for students without disabilities who are learning in inclusive classes. But then there's, as Chris said, the whole social and emotional component. Yeah. And I, you know, I could tell you so many stories about Samuel's peers, his teachers, who have said that they how much they've been impacted by his life, obviously by Jesse's life, by Micah, Nair, and Naomi. You start to see disability as part of the natural diversity of our society, and you learn that this is part of the real world that we live in. And I don't think kids or anybody should be sheltered from that diversity. I think we should see that as really part of our richness. And unfortunately, I really think that people that didn't get the chance to go to school with Jesse or Micah or Nair are being deprived. Mm-hmm. You know, if people with disabilities are being kept in segregated settings.
Nair's father says in the film that we all need to broaden our sense of what intelligence is. What does he mean by that, and how do you do that?
Well, he talks specifically about Nair, his son, and how he sees light and color in a way that he could never see. He hears music in different ways that he wouldn't see. And I mean, how else can we measure intelligence but then to say if somebody is navigating the world in such creative, enterprising ways and making such an impact, what is that? You know, is that intelligence? Is that capability? Should we even put a label on it? Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, from the very beginning, one of my advisors challenged me, you have to just blow up the notion that there's any one way to measure intelligence and just make it much more broad. And that's what we're trying to do with Intelligent Lives.
Well, Chris says finally of his son, Jesse, who loves to write poetry. He quotes the one of his poems. Jesse says in the poem, I am a poet and I speak through my poems and people listen. And it gave me a sense that if we can broaden our sense of how you communicate, broaden our sense of what intelligence is, people are saying things in all kinds of different forms, art and, you know, all kinds of different things. That seems to speak to that.
That's right. And actually, I think that a lot of people I know that have communication challenges, like Nair, like my son Samuel, like Jesse, they also speak so much more efficiently than many of us. You know, here we are talking, having a wonderful conversation for the last 40 minutes or so. But, you know, for Samuel, he says sometimes so much in just one sentence that would take me, you know, 10 minutes to say. And now, isn't that a kind of intelligence also, to just be able to be so efficient in your communication and know how to conserve your energy in certain ways? He also has, you know, Samuel, Jesse, they have these communication devices. And Samuel has thousands of words on his device. He doesn't have to look at it. He has all this motor memory as to where everything is and going page into page after page. That's a kind of intelligence. So I think the challenge is also to apply those type of unconventional intelligences to the quote-unquote real world that we live in, making sure that jobs are seen as being accessible to people. And you know, there's something called job carving, where you might look at a certain job and say, you know what, Nair is going to be really great at doing these three things. Is there a way that we can design the job around his strengths and not his challenges? And that's what I'm hoping we see more and more in societies, people looking at employment and education and community life in more creative ways to tap into strengths and not deficits.
Dan Habib. His documentary film is Intelligent Lives, and you can see it tonight at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.